they are something else.
Do you have a better idea? The girl was only 2 feet away now, preparing to spring. Kelsey tightened her grip on the dagger, murmuring to herself almost a prayer. I put my trust in fiction. Then the girl was upon them, and Kelsey felt her pulse jump, time losing its elasticity and snapping back into itself. She had expected the girl to attack her first, since she was armed, but the child ignored Kelsey and sprang for the Red Queen, knocking her flat. The Red Queen forced her away, but Kelsey sensed that the blow was weak. The Red Queen was faltering. Kelsey grabbed the girl's hair, yanking her backward, but she was astounded at the strength of the child. She came, but her hands did not release the Red Queen's shoulders, and the Red Queen came with her, all three of them tumbling on the hard stone. The dagger flew from Kelsey's hand, clattering to the floor behind her. She detached herself from the pile and scrambled after it, while behind her the Red Queen continued to grapple with the girl, cursing in mort. The dagger had landed against the bars of Simon's cell. Kelsey grabbed it and looked up to see Simon in front of her, inches away, crouching behind his bars. She had never gotten a good look at him before, and now, despite everything behind her, she froze in shock. He was General Hall. But no. She had left Hall in New London, while this man had been imprisoned here for a long time. Hall's brother had gone in the shipment long ago. But Kelsey got no further, for a shriek echoed behind her. The girl had dug her nails into the Red Queen's collarbone, and her mouth was less than an inch from the Red Queen's shoulder. The Red Queen was trying to beat her away with no success. Her eyes rolled in desperation. Tucking her head low, Kelsey ran at the girl and tackled her, breaking her from the Red Queen and knocking her across the flagstones. The child recovered almost immediately, but Kelsey was ready. She jumped on the girl's left arm, pinning it down, and shoved an elbow up underneath the child's throat, holding her dangerous teeth away. "Help me!" she shouted at the Red Queen. "Her other arm!" The Red Queen crawled over. She was injured. Kelsey's mind registered the fact, but there was no time to do anything about it. The girl was writhing beneath her, trying to buck her off, and her strength was unbelievable. Even with the two of them pinning her arms, Kelsey nearly lost the dagger again. "She's too strong!" she shouted. "Hold her, will you?" The Red Queen nodded, and a moment later, Kelsey felt some of the girl's wild strength diminish. "I got her," the Red Queen hissed, "but not for long. Hurry up!" "Father!" the child screamed. "Father, help me!" "One of his," Kelsey's mind repeated. And again she wondered how on earth the boy, Roland Finn, charming and selfish, had travelled the long road to this place. Her hands shook, but she held fast to the dagger, planting one of her knees in the girl's ribcage to stop her wriggling.
"Stop, Majesty," Simon shouted from his cell. "She's a child."
"No child," Kelsey panted. She took a good grip on the dagger. Rogue thought, what if Carlin could see me now, drifted through her head, but she ignored it and brought the dagger down. The blade slipped smoothly into the center of the girl's chest. The child screamed, a terrible sound, both human agony and the wretched squealing of an animal caught in a trap. Her body bucked and spasmed, and both Kelsey and the Red Queen were hurled backward. Kelsey heard a hollow boom as her head hit the bars of Simon's cell, such a resounding impact that her teeth clattered together. There was no pain. Kelsey waited for it, but before it could come, she tumbled into the dark. General Hall had always hated this plan. For one thing, they were relying on Le Vieux, the Phantom of Mortmain, and nothing that Hall had heard about Levieux was a comfort. He claimed to be able to guide them through the palais to the dungeons, even to the queen's cell, but would not tell them how he knew the way. There was nothing to even say whether this was the real Levieux, since no one ever saw the man. One of Levieux's people was a Cadarese, and though Hall had never met any Cadarese, he knew they were not to be trusted. Worst of all, this entire operation relied upon a mob, and despite Levieux's claim that he had given his people clear instructions, Hall knew that no one could truly direct a mob. The northern and western ends of Domaine were now on fire, more than 10 city blocks burning out of control, and the local fire brigade was nowhere to be found. A force assailed the city's northern gate, drawing what little enforcement Domaine still had, but what this force was or where it came from, Levieux refused to say. Hall's operations were designed with certainty in mind, elimination of all variables achieved through repeated testing. This plan was madness, and they would only get one shot. It was too much to risk for one woman, even a queen. But there was no talking to the mace, who seemed to be in the grip of a fixed delusion that if they could only get the queen out, all would somehow be well. No one could convince him otherwise, but Hall, who prided himself on realism, was prepared for disaster. But so far, things had gone without a hitch. The palais gates were open and unguarded, so the mace's plant had at least done her job. There was no sign of any security, and this made Hall uneasy. Surely the woman couldn't have suborned an entire gate guard. Levieux's mob had already flooded the palais, and Hall could hear the sounds of wreckage echoing throughout the upper floors, breaking glass and wood. Their little band, Levieux and four of his people, Hall and Blazer, and eight of the Queen's Guard, had gone in the other direction, down several flights of stairs, following Levieux toward the dungeons. But they met no resistance, met no one of any kind. Their route was stunningly easy, and Hall didn't trust it. Then there was the smell. Hall had been a soldier far too long to miss that copper tang in the air. Blood had been spilled here, plenty of it, and not long ago either. They didn't see a single body, but as they progressed down the stairs, they saw floors and hallways dappled with puddles of red. The mace's plant was supposed to be at the bottom of the stairs, ready to open the doors to the dungeons, but she was nowhere to be seen. Instead, they met a pair of iron gates that looked as though they had been hit with a ram. The bars were warped, and one of the doors dangled by the barest grace from a single hinge. "What in hell did that?" Blazer whispered.
"Ready for anything now," the mace said.
He had pulled out his namesake weapon, and his face was pallid, almost ghastly in the dim torchlight. If something had happened to the queen, Hall wasn't sure what it would do to the mace.
"Come on, let's get it done."
They crept down the staircase, the only sound the flicker and crack of their torches. Hall had been worried that Levieux and his people would be a nuisance, but he needn't have been. They were the quietest of the bunch. Hall didn't hear a single scrape or footstep.
"Sir," Kib said quietly, "got a blood trail here."
Hall looked down and saw it. Every few risers, a small, dark sparkle of blood dotted the grey stone. In all of his worries over this venture, he had never thought that the Queen might be in real danger. She was a valuable prisoner, a bargaining chip. Even if the Red Queen chose to have her beaten for spite, such things went on in the Mort dungeons all the time, the Queen would not face death, or serious injury. But at the sight of the blood, something seemed to tighten in Hall's heart. In the past few weeks, he had revisited his angry words to the Queen many times. He had called her a glory hound. He owed her an apology, but there had been no chance.
"Blood's running in her direction,"
Levieux muttered, and Hall thought that even he was unnerved. Levieux was a cool customer. Hall had met with him only twice, during meetings in the keep, but he had never seen the man rattled until now. The sick feeling in Hall's midsection seemed to double. He had known that this plan was too easy, that something was bound to go wrong. "But please," he begged the universe, "anyone, not so wrong as this." The rumours Hall had heard about the Mort dungeons were not exaggerated. It was bone cold down here, even to a soldier who had slept rough in the outdoor winter on several campaigns. Many of the cells they passed contained not even the standard pallet of the New London jail. Most of the torches on the walls had long since burned out, and there were long stretches during which the torches carried by Levieux and Corin provided the only light. No guards? No jailers? Hall thought. What in holy hell happened here? Whatever it was clear that no one cared whether these prisoners lived or died. Only some of them appeared to have blankets, and many were coughing, hollow, chesty coughs that Hall judged symptomatic of pneumonia. Some of them cried for water, displaying empty buckets through the bars as Hall went by.
"We'll find a key,"
the mace told them, but even Hall heard the unease in his voice. They had expected to fight their way through the dungeons, to break the Queen out or die trying. A grueling bit of combat, to be sure, but at least it would be a known hazard. They had been prepared to lose some of their number, but none of them had anticipated this. In one cell, a heavily pregnant woman begged them to let her out. Behind Hall, one of the Queen's guards uttered a low curse. All the combat in the world seemed preferable to Hall, and he was not alone. Several turns into the dungeon, Blazer silently began to retch.
"How much farther?"
the mace asked Levieux.
2 turns right and down.
As they approached the second turn, all of them slowed, and Hall doubled his grip on his sword. A moment ago, he had been thinking that he would relish an open battle, but now his flesh had begun to crawl. Ahead of them, a staircase descended into darkness, and Hall could feel freezing air emanating from below. The blood trail led down the stairs.
"Quietly,"
Levieux cautioned them, and began to step silently down the staircase. They were forced to go single file now, and Hall took a position behind the great, bear-like form of one of Levieux's men. The staircase wedged them tight, and for a moment Hall was beset by claustrophobia, with the walls closing in and people ahead and behind. The walls reverberated with the thud of many feet above as Levieux's people tore the upper levels of the palais apart. At the bottom of the stairwell, the line halted. The entire corridor was dark, but the stench of blood seemed to have deepened and refined down here, almost precipitant, a low, sickening throb of rusting copper each time Hall took a breath.
"Torches up front,"
the mace murmured, and Corin passed his torch forward. It was enough to illuminate the corridor, but Hall could not see past the shoulder of the enormous man in front of him.
"What is that?"
the mace demanded.
"Don't move,"
said Levieux, but Hall, able to bear the weight no longer, pushed his way around the giant until he could see as well. Far down at the end of the corridor, perhaps 50 feet away, lay a body in front of a cell. The cell door hung wide open. Hall could not identify the body, for there were 2 figures hunched over it, so small that at first he mistook them for vultures. But then one turned, and Hall saw that it was a child, a little boy.
"Get back!" Levieux shouted. "Morgan, Howell, Lear, up here now!"
But it was too tight in the corridor, Levieux's men pushing up toward the front while the rest tried to shove their way back toward the stairs. The mace did not retreat, and so neither did Hall, shoving his way forward until he stood beside the captain.
"What are they?"
the mace asked Levieux.
"The plague on the New World." "They're only children,"
Hall objected.
"Keep thinking that, General, right up until they bleed you dry."
Levieux raised his sword, for now the little boy had clambered to his feet and begun moving forward.
"Who is that?"
Penn demanded, his voice rising.
"Who's dead down there?"
"It's her cell,"
Levieux replied quietly.
"Stay here."
He and his 4 men headed down the corridor, leaving the mace and Hall standing there. Blazer had moved forward to stand at Hall's shoulder, but the rest of the group still crouched near the stairwell.
"The plague," he repeated. "The attacks in the north."
The mace didn't answer, but Hall was already filling in the blanks for himself. He had heard of the destruction in the Reddick and northern Almont. Had Hall still commanded an army, he might already have been sent to get the situation under control. As it was, the force that assailed the Tierling remained unchecked, moving steadily south. There were almost no survivors. The few rumors Hall had heard spoke of animals with incredible strength. But children? The little boy lunged forward with a hiss that made Hall's skin prickle and knocked the Kadaris flying. The other child, a girl, Hall saw now, darted into the fray, wrapped herself around Levieux's leg and sunk her teeth into his thigh.
5 men might not be enough,
the mace said, and ran forward, Hall and Blazer on his heels.
Stay back,
Levieux shouted. He yanked his leg free, cursing, and threw the girl toward the big man, Morgan, who held her struggling form long enough for Levieux to run her through with his sword. The girl shrieked, a sound like the peal of alarm bells.
Christ!
Blazer muttered. Hall turned to the mace to see if he would protest, but the mace merely watched, stone-faced, as though well familiar with this sight. The boy had jumped on top of the Kadaris, Lear, and somehow pinned him down. Now Howell grabbed the child and ran him into the bars hard enough that the boy fell, stunned. Howell grabbed one arm, Alain the other, and Lear straddled the child with a knife. Hall could watch no more. He turned away, closing his eyes when the boy began to scream.
Done,
Levieux said, an unknown amount of time later.
Come on.
The mace moved down the corridor, his guard surrounding him, and Hall followed. He felt as though he were in some sort of waking nightmare. And the scene that met him was more terrible still. The 2 children lay on the ground bleeding. But further down the hall was another child, a girl whom Hall had not noticed before, with a dagger buried in her chest. Just in front of the open cell lay a 4th body, a woman, tall and blonde. And now Hall finally understood why the children had reminded him of vultures. The woman's torso was pulped, her ribs poking cruelly through the leftover meat.
Kibbe?
The mace demanded. Kib had already disappeared inside the queen's cell, and now his voice echoed from inside.
Nothing. No one here.
Hall barely heard this conversation. He had frozen in front of the adjacent cell.
No sign? No message?
No. Pallet, candles, matches, two buckets. That's all.
Where is she? Penn demanded. Hall raised his hand and waved it in front of the bars. The prisoner before him did not wave back. The man's head was shaved and he could have done with a few good meals. But the face was Hall's own, staring back at him.
Simon, he murmured.
Neck's broken.
Corin's voice came from far away. He was leaning over the blonde woman.
Clean death before these things. Oh, damn,
the mace muttered, kneeling beside the corpse.
She did her job.
Simon reached out through the bars, and Hall grasped his hand, resting his other palm on his brother's cheek. Hall had not seen his twin in nearly 20 years, had worked all that time not to think about him at all. Yet here Simon was, solid and real.
But where's the Queen? Elston asked.
In other circumstances, Hall might have laughed at the plaintive note in the big guard's voice. Simon's lips formed words, but nothing came out. Hall leaned toward the bars.
What? The Red Queen. She took her.
What's that you say?
The mace shouldered Hall out of the way, but Hall clung to Simon's hand as he skidded to one side.
The queen hit her head on the bars. The Red Queen carried her away.
The mace looked from Hall to Simon for a moment, then seemed to dismiss the resemblance as a problem for a later time.
Where did she take her?
Simon pointed in the opposite direction to that from which they had come.
How long ago?
I don't know. Many hours, I think. There's no time here.
Fuck!
Hall jumped. Penn stood with his back to them, his shoulders heaving. Hall turned back to Simon, noticing for the first time the cell walls behind him, covered with drawings and schematics. They used to sit for long hours, the two of them, designing contraptions, drawing the plans in the dirt with a stick. Engineers. Hall blinked tears from his eyes and, realizing that Simon was still locked in, began casting around for a key.
Where would she go?
Dyer asked Levieux.
I don't know.
Jin, reach.
The mace's voice was little more than a croak, and Hall saw, alarmed, that the man's face had drained of all colour.
She's in Jin reach. Andalai told us so, and I didn't listen. None of us did,
Elston reminded him. He put a hand on mace's shoulder, but the mace shook him off, and suddenly Hall felt it coming. Sensed that the boiling point inside the captain had finally been reached. The guard seemed to have the same idea, for they instinctively began to back away as a group, turning their heads. Hall turned back to Simon and kept his eyes resolutely on his brother's face as it erupted behind him. A long, wordless howl of rage and grief. Chapter 10. Jin Reach. The malicious have a dark happiness. Les Misérables, Victor Hugo, Pre-Crossing French.
My palais is on fire.
Kelsey jerked awake from a doze that had been deepening toward sleep. They had been riding for nearly a day, and her head was beginning to ache again, sharp throbs of knifing pain that pulsed outward from the enormous knot at the back of her skull. She drew rein and found the Red Queen staring behind them.
"Look."
Kelsey turned and found the silhouette of the Palais jutting upward from the distant Domain skyline. The upper windows belched fire, and the entire apex of the castle, including the balcony on which she and the Red Queen had stood on that long-ago day, was obscured by a dark nimbus of smoke.
"The immortal do not flee,"
the Red Queen murmured, words that sounded almost rote to Kelsey, as though the older woman had practiced them many times in her mind. They had escaped Domain by means of an underground stable that, according to the Red Queen, had been prepared for her long ago by Ducat. The stable was well stocked with clothing, water, cured food, and coin. But the Red Queen's lost expression told Kelsey that she had never expected to need such a place and was astonished to find herself there. Kelsey was scarcely less astonished. The Red Queen, with an escape hatch? She wondered what would have happened if that knowledge had become public. The Red Queen had torn their clothing and ratted Kelsey's hair into a nest. They hid the coins against their skin, and then the Red Queen dappled Kelsey's face with blood from the gash at her wrist. Kelsey didn't entirely understand the reason for these preparations until they emerged from the dim basement of an abandoned building some distance from the palais. They had been able to hear the roar of conflict from underground, but Kelsey was completely unprepared for what met her on the streets. Domain was in chaos. Uncontrolled fires raged at several points on the city's horizon. Mobs roamed free, shouting Le Vieux's name. The district around the palais, clearly one of the city's wealthiest, was a battle zone of barricaded houses under assault by both citizens and Mort soldiers. They didn't want to be discovered as wealthy on these streets, but Kelsey couldn't seem to work up any fear, for it felt too extraordinary to be outside again. She had almost forgotten that there was anything but the fetid air of the dungeon, the dim light of torches. Even this wrecked city was a welcome landscape. At several points on their journey through the city, Kelsey briefly considered simply breaking cover and turning the Red Queen in, then presenting herself as a Tyr slave. The streets were full of Tyr voices, escaped slaves, now turned rebels, and surely the Mort would not be interested in a lone Tyr when they got hold of the noble to end all nobles. Surely Kelsey was justified in leaving the Red Queen behind. She had spared the Red Queen's life, and the Red Queen had spared hers. There was no debt here. And the Tyrling beckoned, distant, but suddenly close. Once she got out of the city, she could ride straight west and cross the border in little more than a day. Home. Of course, the idea was foolish. Domain was a vast city, and Kelsey had no idea where she was. She was forced to trust the Red Queen's navigation, and they had finally escaped Domain by bribing 5 soldiers on the city's south gate. Once out, they had ignored the Mort Road and begun a steady journey southwest. Kelsey had no idea where the Red Queen meant to go, but as long as they were heading toward the Tyrling, she felt no need to deviate. She was surprised to feel an odd sense of responsibility for the Red Queen. The woman was all alone now, cast adrift in a country that screamed for her blood. If the Red Queen were caught, what the Mort would do to her would be bad, very bad. But what the Tyr would do would be even worse. She could not go unpunished, Kelsey's mind insisted. Not forever. But Kelsey didn't want to see her brutalized either.
The girl by my side.
The Red Queen continued now, her voice distant, as she stared at the flaming ruin far behind them.
The girl by my side, and the man in grey behind.
Are you casting a spell? Kelsey asked. Or talking nonsense? The Red Queen turned to her, and Kelsey felt an involuntary shudder work its way up her spine. Whatever her relationship with Tyr's Sapphire, and Kelsey had no idea precisely what that was, it still allowed her to see, to catalogue and analyze the small ticks that other people tried to keep hidden. Over the course of this day, she had become more and more certain that the Red Queen was only holding herself together by the barest margin. A maniac, Thorn had named her. And how would such a person really do under the pressures of blind flight? Beneath the Red Queen's business-like exterior, the exigencies of getting themselves out of domain, Kelsey sensed the first threads of madness.
I am not immortal, said the Red Queen.
The look she bent on Kelsey was a mixture of hatred and obsequiousness, and Kelsey was not sure which one made her more uncomfortable.
Are you happy, Glynn? You have brought me down.
You brought yourself down, Kelsey snapped. All that power? You could have done anything with it, and look what you did.
I did what I had to do to hold my throne.
You're a liar. I know about your court, Lady Crimson. I know how you conducted yourself. Slaves tortured and raped, and the men, too. Don't think I haven't heard about your predilections. People enter your laboratories and never come out. That's not necessity. That's carte blanche. The Red Queen's face darkened, and Kelsey felt something ruffle her hair, though the air was still.
"Be careful," she said softly. "You do not want to open this box."
The Red Queen stared at her for another long moment, then muttered a curse and turned back to the city. "We've gained enough distance, Lady Crimson. Why don't we just go our separate ways?"
"Well, you may if you like, Glynn," the Red Queen replied. "But I would just as soon hold together until our paths diverge. Two women together are safer than one."
That was certainly true, but Kelsey sensed the falsity behind the statement. They were no ordinary women, and the man who tried to rob or assault either of them would certainly regret it. The Red Queen was afraid of something else. Finn's children, perhaps? They had seen no more of the horrible things since leaving the palais, but Kelsey could think of nothing else that would frighten this woman, save perhaps for Finn himself. They had stopped several hours ago to rest and take some food and water, but the older woman had forbidden Kelsey to light a fire. The Red Queen was rubbing her wrist again. In the stable, Kelsey had dressed the wound, washing it with water and wrapping a bandage. The two punctures were very deep, and they had already looked inflamed. Bite marks.
What?
The Red Queen had caught her staring. Kelsey turned away, looking across the landscape. They had finally left the broad, trimmed grass of the Champ de Maine behind. The ground beneath them had turned to high grassland, shot through with veins of silt. It was slightly better cover, but not the most comfortable place to spend the night. "We should keep moving," Kelsey said. "Where is it you mean to go in the end?"
"To the dry lands. There is nowhere else I can hide."
"What about Kader?"
"I can't go to Kader,"
the Red Queen replied flatly. "Well, I can stay with you until we cross the border,
After that, I need to return to my city.
That's fine, the Red Queen replied, her voice unconcerned.
And again, Kelsey had the strange sense that the woman didn't care where they went, so long as they went together. What is she afraid of? They rode southwest for the next several hours. When the sun touched the horizon, they stopped to rest within sight of the border hills. This far south, the land was not covered with pines, only grass and shrubs and occasional greenery. Boring landscape, but still Kelsey stared at her surroundings, fascinated. Less than 50 miles to the north, Hall had made his stand, and Dukat had forced the Tyr army off the hillside by setting the forest on fire. Even Kelsey, who would have liked to see Dukat in a Tyr prison for the rest of his life, had to admire the simplicity of the strategy. If your opponent would not be moved, you simply burned him down. Dinner was another meal of cured meat and fruit. There was plenty of game around here, deer and rabbits, but the Red Queen had once again forbade Kelsey to light a fire. "Did you ever try to kill him?" Kelsey asked. "Roe Finn?"
"Yes. I failed. He's not quite mortal. No shape, I couldn't grab hold."
Kelsey didn't perfectly understand the Red Queen's words, but she thought she had some idea. When she killed Arlan Thorn, she had been able to see to the core of him, not solid, but solid enough, limned in poisonous light, and a younger and angrier Kelsey, desperate over all the things beyond her control, had had no trouble gaining hold. "Do you know how he became what he is?"
"The dark thing. In some ways. He used to speak of it. After..."
Here the Red Queen paused, casting a furtive glance in Kelsey's direction.
"He used to say that he had forced his own survival. Almost bragging, I think. He used to teach me things."
"How long were you up in the Fair Witch?"
2 years. Long enough for all who knew me to think me dead."
Kelsey saw a brief flash of hatred in her eyes.
"But you know this, Glynn. You know all about me."
"Not all. I don't see clearly. It's like skimming a book. Why did your mother send you into exile?"
"She didn't. I ran away."
"Why?"
"None of your fucking business."
Kelsey blinked, but persevered. "Did you learn magic from Finn?"
"Some. Enough that when the time came I was able to create my own, but not enough to ward off disaster."
The Red Queen frowned, and Kelsey noticed that she was rubbing her bandaged wrist again, working at it with her fingers. "Does it hurt?" Kelsey asked. The Red Queen didn't answer. They continued to travel southwest. The weather grew colder, and soon the land began to dry. Streams and rivers vanished, and even watering holes and wells became scarce. In a small village in the lower flats, they stopped, and Kelsey traded gold for water, bargaining in mort, while the Red Queen stood silent behind her. Often, Kelsey thought of how she could simply vanish, leave the Red Queen behind and make straight for New London. She was the better rider. In fact, she thought the Red Queen might even be secretly frightened of horses. How long had it been since the woman had left Domain, or travelled anywhere without a driver? Out of the palais, the Red Queen had begun to seem less substantial, not the witch sorceress of Mort Main, but only an ordinary woman, lonely and lost. What were initially small things, scattered focus, tremors in her speech, became more pronounced the farther they travelled from Domain.
The Red Queen looked behind them constantly, and Kelsey could not tell whether she truly saw something or whether the natural terminus of her paranoia had finally been reached. "What is it?" she finally asked, when the Red Queen pulled her horse to a halt for the third time that afternoon.
"We're being followed," the Red Queen replied,
and Kelsey was unnerved by the certainty in her tone. The Red Queen had begun to rub her wrist again. "Let me take a look at that," Kelsey offered.
"Get away!"
the Red Queen hissed, slapping her hand away, and Kelsey withdrew with a gasp. For a moment, she could have sworn the Red Queen's eyes had gleamed a bright, burning red. "Do I need to restrain you?" Kelsey asked flatly.
"No. I will beat it. I control my own body, even if I control nothing else."
Kelsey had her doubts, but she could think of no way to act on them. Even if she succeeded in subduing the Red Queen, where could she go with a bound woman? She felt again the urge to simply cut loose, flee north toward her own city, her keep, her life. But again, something held her back. "What ties me to her?" Kelsey wondered. "What binds us together?" She had gone through the woman's mind as one might search a dwelling, carelessly, with no regard for decency or privacy. And only now did Kelsey realize that there might have been cost attached to that invasion, a price she had never considered.
"Don't worry about me," the Red Queen said roughly. "Let's go on."
On the third day of their journey, they climbed the gentle slopes of the lower border hills, and Kelsey was finally able to look out over her kingdom, the vast plain of the Almont stretching before her as far as the eye could see. Instead of the pleasures she had expected, she felt almost sick. She had sacrificed much for this broad stretch of land, her imperfect country, but something told her she wasn't done yet. When she looked down, she found herself clutching William Tyr's sapphire in a hand that was damp with sweat. That afternoon, they reached the beginning of the drylands, more than 100 miles of desert that stretched across the Kedaeri's border. They would need to stop and purchase cold weather gear, furs and tents. Carlin had once told Kelsey that the dry lands became nearly as cold as the Fairwitch in winter. In the distance, Kelsey could see several dark spots, scattered villages, but all around them stretched a vast landscape, parched and colourless, and unforgiving. Kelsey sensed no end to it, even beyond the horizon. Far to the west, she saw a stain in the sky, punctuated by lightning. The storms in the drylands were legendary, fearsome and inexplicable ecological phenomena in which the water seemed to come from nowhere. Torrents of rain poured down, but the water did not alter the character of the landscape one whit. Everything remained as parched as before. Technically, the drylands were part of the Tierling, but to Kelsey, the desert seemed to be its own kingdom, lonely and cold. "What do you mean to do?" she asked the Red Queen. "We'll die trying to cross that." The Red Queen turned, a mad sort of desperation in her eyes. She was clutching at her wrist again.
"He knows where I am,"
she said quietly.
"I can feel it. He'll send more. I need to get away."
"Well, you can't hide in the desert."
"What's your point?"
"Why not come back to New London with me?" Kelsey asked. "I'll..." She halted, unable to credit the words that had almost escaped her mouth. "I'll protect you." But she couldn't do that. The Tyr would treat the Red Queen as a war criminal, and they would be right to do so. One of those outposts is bound to have an inn, she finished lamely. We have enough coin for a proper bed and bath at least. The Red Queen swallowed and nodded, putting on a good front of her old self-control. But to Kelsey's eye it was only a shadow of the real thing. Unraveling, she thought again. The Red Queen blinked, and this time Kelsey couldn't deceive herself. The woman's pupils were tinged with red.
Yes, the Red Queen replied. A bath and bed. That would be nice.
The first village they came to was little more than a hamlet, a town as grim as the landscape surrounding. As they started down the narrow sand track that seemed to pass as the main road, Kelsey spotted a small, weather-beaten sign driven into the sandy earth. Gin Reach. The houses were little more than functional piles of wood, and no one had taken any trouble to make them prettier. Only one building had glass windows and a bright, pleasant awning. Kelsey was hardly surprised to see that it was the town's pub. She thought she felt eyes staring down upon her, but when she looked up, she found that all of the second-story windows were shuttered. The wind had picked up, blowing sand against Kelsey's face. A storm was coming, and the entire town appeared to be battening down the hatches. The town's inn turned out to be a large house, boasting three guest rooms. The keeper assured them that he had only one guest. The two of them would have their privacy, a remark followed with a distinctly lecherous wink. The Red Queen didn't seem to care, dropping down coin for two hot baths to be brought to their room. After the luxury and callousness Kelsey had seen littering the palais, she would have expected the Red Queen to do poorly at a small-town inn. But she seemed fine, giving an easy riposte when the innkeeper tried to flirt, and this made Kelsey wonder again at what she had missed inside the Red Queen's mind, the complex life she must have led. When they undressed for their baths, the Red Queen removed her bandages, and Kelsey saw that the marks on her wrist had disappeared. Kelsey's unease doubled. The punctures she had treated had been deep and nasty, and if this was no natural healing, then what was it? As they bathed, each lounging in her own steel tub, Kelsey watched the Red Queen from the corner of her eye. She showed few signs of fatigue. Indeed, despite the cold weather they had been travelling under, the Red Queen looked physically strong. Stronger than she had since they set out from Demain. What am I afraid of? Kelsey wondered, as they climbed into their beds. She couldn't say, but her skin was prickling, as though an invisible animal waited just behind her ready to pounce. She felt eyes on her again, but when she glanced at the Red Queen, she found her turned away, resting comfortably on her side in the other bed. Kelsey tried to stay awake, but exhaustion overtook her, and finally she gave up trying to keep watch and blew out her candle. A terrible storm was upon the town, thunder that shook the building to its foundations, and Kelsey slipped easily into a dream of the Argive, the train of cages that had sat just on the border. If Kelsey and her guard had come even a day later, the caravan would have gone, vanished into Mortmain. That was a moment, the dream Kelsey thought, a moment in time. Just like the death of Jonathan Tyr. If I had missed that moment, what would have happened? Where would we be now? But the dream of the Argive was gone, morphed seamlessly into another. Kelsey stood on the high scaffold, and before her was Arlen Thorne driven to his knees. All around them the mob raged, a cacophony of screaming voices. Thorne looked up, and Kelsey saw that he was in his final extremity, his face a mask of blood. "I'm sorry," Kelsey tried to scream, but before she could, a hand grabbed her ankle. She looked down and saw Mern at her feet, grinning wide, his face upturned, exposing the wide red smile she had cut into his neck. His hand began to work its way up her calf, and Kelsey did the only thing she could do, jumped off the scaffolding and into the sea of upturned, screaming faces awaiting her. At the last moment before she landed, she realized that they were all Mern and Thorne waiting for her, and she gasped herself awake. A woman stood over her in the dark. Before Kelsey could even draw breath to scream, a hand jammed over her mouth. There was great strength in this woman. She held Kelsey's shoulders easily, pinning her to the bed. "I was wrong," Kelsey thought bitterly. Whatever the Red Queen had become, Kelsey should never have taken her eyes off her, just as Mace would never take his eyes off a known enemy. She had allowed herself to be lulled by companionship and mutual interest, lulled into forgetting that there was more than a century of hatred sitting between Mortmain and the Tyr, between red and black. The Red Queen bent down, her face nearing Kelsey's, and Kelsey heard the whistle of the woman's breath at her ear, thought she could feel the bite of teeth against her throat.
"You will suffer, bitch,"
the Red Queen hissed in the darkness.
"You will suffer for my master."
Kelsey froze in sudden recognition. The threat had been real, but she had mistaken the source. Not the Red Queen at all, but... "Brenna," she whispered. Ewan was not good with new places. He had lived in New London all of his life, but several times he had gotten lost in strange sections of the city. Dar said Ewan had no compass inside. But after 2 weeks in Gin Reach, Ewan thought that even Dar would be satisfied. He knew every inch of the town's four streets, and could even recognize who lived in some of the houses. He and Bradshaw had caused a stir when they arrived. Bradshaw said it was because they had money to spend. This confused Ewan, for Gin Reach held very little to spend money on. Once a week, a sour-looking man drove a covered wagon down the main track and stopped in front of the pub. While the publican and his assistant removed bottles and barrels from the wagon, the townspeople came out of their houses to bargain with the sour man for food, clothing, or for a few novelties such as paper or fabric or medicine. The town had a small, grim farming patch out behind the southern stretch of houses, protected from the desert with fencing and canvas tarp, and most of what people seemed to barter was the food they grew. Root vegetables, leeks, and potatoes, things that needed little light. But the only places to spend actual coin in Gin Reach were the pub and the inn. When Ewan saw the witch, he almost didn't recognize her. The woman Ewan remembered had been white as bone, ageless, with eyes like daggers. She might have been 20 years old, or 50. But the woman he saw now was red-cheeked and looked to be in the prime of youth. Her hair, which had been the colour of sun-faded straw when Ewan last saw her, was a rich, healthy gold. She was much changed, yes, but he still recognised the witch beneath, standing in the doorway of the inn. She didn't see him, for at the sight of her, Ewan dove for cover into a narrow alley between two houses.
That night, he and Bradshaw had a long talk about what to do. Bradshaw said that Brenna's powers were well known, that she could control even strong men with a glance. Neither of them felt comfortable about trying to capture her, not even the two of them against one. But Bradshaw insisted that the mace must be told, that one of them must stay in Jinreach while the other took the message. Ewan did not want to stay here. Every moment that day, trailing her from the inn, he had felt as though Brenna would turn around and spear him with her eyes. He had not dared to follow her as she wandered into the desert, for there was no cover out there. And anyway, even Ewan knew about the drylands. Dar used to say that the desert liked to show a man hidden pictures, things that weren't there, draw him away and get him lost. Men would die of thirst, simply chasing the pictures in their heads. Ewan waited in front of the inn until Brenna returned at sunset and disappeared inside, and then he fled back to the basement room he shared with Bradshaw, feeling like a mouse dismissed by a hawk. No, he did not want to stay here, keeping an eye on Brenna. But the alternative was worse. They had been in Jinreach for 2 weeks, and by now General Hall might have been forced to move. If the regiment was not where they had left it, in the southern Almont, Bradshaw said, then the messenger would have to go all the way to Mortmain and make contact with the mace. Mortmain? The most terrible of all lands? A place of darkness and fire and cruelty? He did not want to stay alone in Jinreach, but even less did he want to visit an evil kingdom. Bradshaw insisted that Mortmain was not so bad as all that, but Ewan did not want to find out. Even the mention of the journey was enough to make him sick to his stomach.
"Well, one of us has to go," Bradshaw said firmly, "and if it has to be me, then you'll need to be very careful here, Ewan. The witch can't spot you, or you're cooked. Understand?"
Ewan nodded half-heartedly. Bradshaw left, and in the days since, Ewan had become a spy. This was not easy work, for each day he would have to come up with a new and creative way to watch the inn, not only so that Brenna did not notice, but so that the townspeople didn't begin to talk. He often went to the pub, which was only a bit down the street from the inn, and had a good view of its entrance. But this was not easy either, for Ewan didn't drink. Long ago, Dar had cautioned him against ale, warning that it would only get him into trouble, and he had absolutely forbidden Ewan to drink any spirits. The latter was no hardship. Ewan had tasted whiskey at Christmas once, and thought it tasted like bad vinegar. But Dar's strictures did present problems now, when Ewan was trying to spend all day in a pub. Even he knew that no one spent all day in a pub unless he was a drunk. He thought about getting an ale and sipping it slowly, but in the end he could not. Dar was dead, yes, but that made his rules more powerful, not less. Ewan could not break them. He told the publican that he was waiting for a friend to arrive in town, and after some discussion, they agreed that Ewan would drink water and pay ale prices. Ewan worried that the man would talk about their strange arrangement, but his worries were needless. Unless the discussion involved money or alcohol, the publican didn't seem to want to talk at all. He was content to have Ewan sit at the end of the bar, drinking glass after glass of water, only getting up occasionally to use the filthy toilet at the back of the pub. It was very boring, this spy work, and on the second day, Ewan brought his lead and paper and began to sketch the people around the bar, the street outside. He knew his sketches were not very good, but the publican at least seemed to appreciate them. After several hours of apparent disinterest, he sidled over to watch Ewan draw.
After several more hours, he asked Ewan if he might draw something as well. Ewan gave him a piece of paper and a short stub of lead. He wondered if anyone ever drew in Jin Reach. There wasn't much inspiration here.